This week on the show, if it's news, it will find you. Good bloggers are thinkers and linkers, and news is a living article. All this on This Week in Media, episode 116. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back. This is Daisy Whitney, hosting TWIM this week. Daisy Whitney of the New Media Minute and TV Week and Twitter.com/Daisy Whitney. Follow me because I have less Twitter followers now than Brian Stelter, one of our guests. Not that I'm competitive on Twitter or anything, but I was so disturbed. Tell my husband last week, I'm like, oh my God, Brian surpassed me. And my husband says, yeah, he works at the New York Times, Daisy, okay? I hope he has more Twitter followers than you. Anyway, let me introduce our guest. I'll go ahead and introduce Brian. Brian Stelter from the New York Times. He is an excellent reporter over there. I read a lot of his stories. And Brian, tell our listeners sort of broadly what you cover over at the New York Times.
You know, I did lose a follower yesterday, and of course I spent an hour trying to figure out who dropped me on Twitter. I write about television and digital media for the Times.
Are you using Quitter?
Now that I've heard about it, I'm going to.
No, don't. Now, how do you know you lost a follower, though?
I didn't.
Oh, because
keep,
of the numbers,
too careful,
of course.
Track. Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I Martin Sargent mentioned Quitter a couple episodes ago, when he was on the show, and I installed it just out of morbid curiosity, and it was really incredibly depressing to see how many people quit following me every day. So after about 5 or 6 days, I got rid of Quitter, and I said, you know what? Ignorance is bliss. I don't need to know who has lost interest in me. So much, much happier now. Of course, we have Alex Lindsay in the studio, as always. Thank
you,
Alex.
Hello. Hey.
Good to have you here.
My last time for a while in the studio.
Now, Alex is going to Tokyo tomorrow.
I am, for the rest of the year.
But Alex will be joining us via Skype.
Evidently, the rumor is that the hotel has a bandwidth that's like 10 times faster than my office.
Now, I've been to Tokyo twice, a vacation there, and I love it there. If I could live there, I would. Every time I've been there, though, the wireless access has been horrible. But you're probably staying in a nicer hotel than I did. We were slumming it.
I have no idea. You know, the production company is paying for it, so they got me wherever. I'm going to show up at the airport, someone's going to have a little sign, and then I'm going to be at a hotel. So I don't really know anything about it other than that's where I'll go.
Well, that's the way to travel. You don't have to think about it. Let
I prefer
other people
not
do
thinking.
The work for you.
Yeah, as little as possible.
No, I always think. That's a good thing. Also in the studio, we have David Cohn. He's also a first-time guest on Twitter. We have a lot of first-time guests. David is the founder behind Spot.us, which is Spot.us. And just tell us very quickly, give us your 25 words or less on what that is so listeners kind of get to know as we're talking.
Sure. Spot.us is trying to figure out what I call community-funded reporting. So it's the idea of distributing the cost of hiring a journalist in your local community. So 50 people giving $10 to $25 each, that's enough to hire a reporter to then do a story that's important to those 50 people.
Well, Brian, we'll have to discuss if those rates are good enough. Then we also have Skyping in Patrick Thornton, and Patrick is the editor of beatblogging.org. Thank you, Patrick, for joining us. What is beat blogging?
It's a journalism project where we look at how beat reporters are using online tools and social media to innovate on the web. We've actually interviewed Brian before, and we're looking at how people are using things like Twitter and Facebook to kind of build a community around their beats and how they're harnessing that community to help them report better.
And I have a lot of thoughts on that, and I definitely want to chat about that later, but I have just found really harnessing social networks and Twitter and Facebook to be incredibly useful in finding sources and in finding new sources and in learning things that I didn't already know as a reporter, which is a good thing. I mean, I hope that one of the things that the journalists among us do is always keep learning. So as you can probably guess, we're going to kind of have a special focus to TWIM this week. I really wanted to talk about new media and journalism and how coverage is changing, just how the media business is changing and the reporting of news is changing and how news outlets are adapting. And I want to thank Daniel Bachhuber. I hope I pronounced your name correctly. He is one of our longtime listeners, and he encouraged me to do this episode and connected me with David and with Patrick. So thank you for helping me put together what I think will be a really interesting roundtable of experts to talk about the changes in journalism. And I guess the first question is, and Brian, I'm going to start with you because you're at the New York Times. How bad is it? I mean, we hear, you know, we certainly hear reports every day. And I know you're not a spokesperson for the Times, so I don't expect you to have to, you know, comment specifically on quarterly reports at your publication or anything like that. You know, but just
I've stopped reading the quarterly reports here, but
you know, I shred my financial statements as they come in. Like, I don't even need to know how much I've lost. There's no point in knowing. But just as somebody who cares about journalism, from where you sit, how bad is it? Layoffs and changes and print is dying and so on and so forth. What do you think?
You know, I'm in an echo chamber, so it's hard to answer that exactly. But I think that David Carr hit it on the head a few weeks ago when he said that, you know, what we have is not an audience problem, but a consumer problem. That we have an audience, and we need to figure out how to get them to pay for the content we're producing. You know, obviously, I read the daily items from a wide swath of media companies and reading about the layoffs that are coming. And it does seem to have picked up steam in the past month or two. I don't think we know how bad it is yet, though. Maybe I'm trying to avoid the question, but I think it's too early to tell. It's too early to zoom out and say, here's where we are and here's how many jobs have been lost.
So Patrick, from where you sit, what do you see as the big changes that are still going to come that will roil journalism as we have known it?
Well, unlike Brian, I think I can answer that. I can't say how bad it's going to get, but I think that 2009 is going to be a lot worse than 2008. And 2008 has been a very bad year, but I'm starting to call 2009 the year of the newspaper massacre. We're going to lose a lot more jobs. And the big problem is it's not so much getting people to pay for it. It's that newspapers have traditionally been advertising supported. And the in a global financial crisis we're in right now, advertising is obviously contracting. But beyond that, advertisers have been fleeing newspapers as well, and there are better ways for them to advertise. So I think one of the issues that a lot of newspapers have, and the New York Times isn't quite in this category because it's kind of an international publication. It's got it's a little bit different than most major newspapers. Most major newspapers are just general interest publications, and we are no longer in a general interest world. We're in a niche world, and that's a fundamental problem they're going to face. How can they compete when they basically do a lot of things and they do nothing well? And the answer to that is I think most of them just simply won't be able to compete.
Well, and isn't that why the Christian Science Monitor changed from being a print publication and now that's just online? Because that really was a sort of day after publication, wasn't it,
well,
Alex?
Another thing that happened over last week, I guess, is that PC Magazine has announced that they're going to an online publication only as well. And you know, I think that part of it is also it's not that they're necessarily going under. They're just realizing that a lot of people are reading it. I read the New York Times every morning. I don't pick up the paper ever.
You read it all online.
I'm sitting there sitting either on my laptop on the bus, you know, or you know, I have a long bus ride from Petaluma. So
you're taking the bus in now?
Yeah, it's a direct shot.
For green Alex.
Well,
it's
yay for efficient Alex. It has has nothing to do with green. It has everything to do with that I get to sit there in the back seat with my EVDO modem and sit there and surf the New York Times.
Come on, be a tree hugger. Admit you're a tree hugger.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, so the. The idea, you know, it's very, I find papers, I mean, I think this is the issue, it's kind of annoying, you know, because then I have to open them up and I can move them around and I have to do all this other stuff with
them. They're incredibly hard to plug in.
Well, no, it's just that, but I always feel like I'm wrestling with them, you know, like I'm wrestling trying to get the pages that I want and everything else. Yeah. And when you plug them in, they go on, they catch fire, you know? And so but with my iPhone, you know, I sit there and just scroll with my little finger or with my thing. And I think that that's something that has to that's happening very quickly. I think faster than some people expected.
And I don't think and we can talk more about revenue shortly, but I don't think the revenue, I think it probably will. I don't know that it will make up for what's lost on the print side. But I think that the revenue hasn't quite yet caught up to the consumption. Because I don't know. I wonder, though, if we're consuming more. It certainly feels like, at least in these last few months, that we as consumers, right? I mean, doesn't it feel like we have been ravenous for news? I mean, first the election, then the crisis.
I think we're consuming more online. I think much more online because it's much more instantaneous. I mean, we know what the stock... We don't have to wait until tomorrow to find out how the stock market's going. I mean, I have it up on my, up in the corner watching it go down and down and down. You know, and so... So we want that instantaneous. I think that's the problem is that now even daily isn't a fast enough cycle.
Now, Brian, I'm curious as somebody who's out of print publication but is very new media savvy, how do you read your own paper?
Most of the week, I read it in print, you know, because I walk in the door and grab a copy. But it was interesting for me yesterday, Sunday, I read most of the paper by Saturday night because you can watch it. You can watch Sunday paper come online as early as Wednesday. I was at my girlfriend's house yesterday with her mom on the phone fighting with the New York Times subscriber line. I guess that they had stopped delivering the paper for some reason and she was trying to get a lower rate for it, et cetera. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I already read it all online. Why hasn't everyone else? I think we're getting to that point where more and more people are making that move to the web. And I think the person earlier was right. It is happening faster than expected. But hey, in defense of print, we still have 800,000 people who pick up a copy every day. And until that subscriber base erodes further, there is at least some value of print.
So why? So okay, then this interesting report. I'm not sure when this came out. This might have been a few weeks ago. I don't know that it's necessarily like fresh, hot off the press, so to speak. But I still think it's important to discuss. And is that the Newspaper Association of America released quarterly numbers for September, and for the first time, that's when online ad revenue, which it started tracking 5 years ago, started to dip. So not growing as much as it had been growing.
Well, your point about consumption is happening much faster than the advertising, the monetization of it is absolutely true. We're waiting for it to catch up.
Do we have enough time for it to catch up? Think about the papers that are either shutting their doors or switching to online only. Which, look, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I love reading stuff on the web and getting news on the web. It can be a bad thing initially from a revenue standpoint. But is there enough time for
I think
that
when you catch ask
up
that,
to occur?
I think that's when we're supposed to have our long, awkward, silent pause. I think that's supposed to be the pause, the drama of the film or something.
Do we know, David? Do we know if there's enough time for it to catch up?
Well, this is David. I wouldn't say if we know, but I'll say this. It's a lot like trying to change the wheels while the car is in motion. newspapers traditionally get something like 80% or more of their revenue from the print advertising. And while we have noticed that there is an increase in sort of consumption of news, journalism as a process is actually doing great. There's more of it happening than ever before. The ability to monetize it just isn't there right now with online advertising. It hasn't caught up. Or you have giants like Google, which have sort of become the new monopoly of it. Maybe monopoly is a strong word, but it isn't there right now to monetize. And I think the next 3 to 6 months are going to be a really wild ride. And we're going to start to see mid-sized cities, Seattle, San Francisco-sized cities, losing their daily papers. That's not an impossible thing to imagine right now.
Do you think, will there be a shift then? And I guess maybe that's where you come in, because I think when we think about losing daily regional papers, and to be quite honest, like I don't read the San Francisco Chronicle, and maybe that's bad. Maybe I should be more tapped into local issues, and I'm not. You know, and I do my best to sort of cover my industry and, you know, broad national news, and then after that, you know, my brain is fried. But obviously that's important to a lot of people, and that's one of the reasons that we even have papers in the first place, is to sort of investigate, you know, local fraud and local concerns for taxpayers. But I guess that's sort of where you come in, David, to what have been some of the projects that you've worked on, and do you feel they have been effective in the same way that investigative journalism into community-centric issues has been effective for local papers?
Well, it's a little early to tell right now with Spot Us. We've actually just launched about 2.5 weeks ago. But I'll tell you this, and I'll even tell you two stories that we have already funded. small or mid-sized newspapers do play an important role in civic communities at the local level. Like, I don't think New York Times is going to go under, Washington Post, CNN. I think we're always going to have these large national news organizations to sort of cover these important national investigations. But at the local level, no problem.
We love the New York Times.
I do. I sincerely believe that. I don't think the New York Times is going to crumble. But, you know, you look at something like McClatchy, which is a newspaper organization. They own 30 papers, most of them throughout California. It's reasonable that they're going to have to file bankruptcy, and then you're going to have local investigations disappear. And two of the stories that we funded in just the 2 weeks that we've been up, one of them is about the rise of tent cities outside of the Bay Area, right, as people are losing their homes, but they're sort of not destitute, so they're coming together. That's an important story to tell. And also another will be an investigation on how Bay Area cities can plan ahead for the increase in retirees as the baby boomers get, you know, reach into their golden years. That might not sound like a really exciting story, but it's an important story to be told, right, so that city governments can read that and understand what is going to be required of them as we get more and more elderly. Right.
So who's your army comprised of? Do you have former journalists? Are they kind of citizen journalists doing the investigations?
It can be a little bit of both, actually. I'll give you two starkest contrasts. One pitch on Spot Us is from a 22-year veteran reporter recently laid off, and the other is from a recent sort of journalism graduate. You know, he wouldn't be someone that you'd call a professional journalist because he doesn't have a long career in it, and in fact, he drives a taxi right now to pay the bills. But he very much wants to be a journalist, and he has his own startup called VidSF here in San Francisco, and he's looking for money to, you know, help pay the bills and also let him explore his journalism enterprise.
And where does your funding come from?
For Spot Us, it comes from the Knight Foundation. That's how we are sort of got started and built out this framework. And they're literally giving out grants to people who are going to do research and development in new business models or new ways of doing journalism. And then, of course, for the stories, it comes from small individual donors, you know, 20 people giving $25 each.
Now, when you talk about sort of Knight Foundation believing in new ways of doing journalism, and this is where we get our crystal ball out, or, you know, 20,000, 30,000 foot view. Patrick, I'd love to hear from you because that's really, I mean, you're exploring how journalists are using social media, but by doing that, you're also really kind of looking down the road of the future of journalism, aside from the brass tacks of what's happening at newspapers and in print journalism. How is the mechanism of journalism changing, and what do you think it looks like a couple years down the road?
Well, I think definitely that social media is helping the journalists who are harnessing it. It's allowed them to discover stories that they would never discovered before. It's allowing them to look over large documents or databases and kind of parse that out to different individuals and have them look through it. So social media in the short run is certainly helping journalists to report better. And then within the next 5 to 10 years, I mean, it's hard to say where journalism goes. I do think you're going to see more smaller projects. You're going to see more Spot Us kind of things. I think you're also going to see a lot more niche publications. One of the issues that most newspapers have, as I said before, is that they kind of cover everything, but nothing really in depth. And because most of them are kind of metro focused, they don't really cover a lot of those individual communities particularly well. And I think that's where you're going to start seeing more like startups move into is in the space of local reporting that most metro newspapers have kind of just gotten out of. And so that's probably where we're going to go into. Since they're going to be online only publications, they're going to be much lighter. They're going to employ a lot less people, but they're also probably going to need to do something like I like to call curation, where they're going to have to link to other resources. They're going to have to grab Flickr photos, YouTube videos from people in the community. And I think it's going to kind of be a little bit of a partnership between these small publications and the full-time people they employ, and then people out in the community helping to report on things as well.
Now, you mentioned linked journalism. Brian, I know you had a story on that a couple of weeks ago when the NBC TV stations relaunched, and how for one of the first times a TV station group was employing linked journalism, which essentially is where you no longer as a publication link just to your own stories, you link out. We do that at TV Week. I mean, we link to our direct competitors, broadcasting and cable.
Yeah.
How
which leads
is
me
that
to go
just
back
something
to that
you
site,
have
10
to
times
do?
A day.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I said that's why I go back to the site 10 times a day and check in again and again on that business wire. You know, in a matter of weeks, we'll be rolling out on the New York Times a technology that will show links to our competitors under stories using that company. We a site called BlogRunner using that kind of technology. So we're clearly moving in that direction. But I think talking about having these broad newspapers that aren't experts in anything, I think we're already moving toward this model of having 100 or 200 different slices of a website devoted to particular topics. Look at all the blogs on the New York Times website. They are, you know, deep, very in-depth sort of looks at New York City, at politics, mine about TV, etc. And I think some of that content, more and more of that content, gets repurposed in print. So the web becomes even more of an early warning system, even more of a republishing tool for print. I think we're moving much more in that direction, but we can already see parts of it, like I'm describing.
What are the risks with that, though? I mean, that's one of the things that your story raised, that we haven't traditionally done that. Do you really want to drive somebody to your competitor? And, you know, I tend to agree with you that in this day and age, you don't really have a choice. You have to sort of embrace competition. I mean, and I think too, competition is changing for journalists. We've always been so secretive and understandably and so competitive. And I don't think that has necessarily changed. But I feel that especially in the last few years, you know, journalists in the same beat have had to embrace more of an openness where I will write about your stories in my blog, or I'll mention what Andy Wallenstein at The Hollywood Reporter is doing, or when Michael Learmonth was at Silicon Alley Insider, you know, just sort of recognizing you can't break everything anymore. Yeah. So just as reporters, we kind of have to be these curators too, don't we?
Please.
Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
Well, I was just going to say, it makes the conversations more transparent. You know, we are already internally in our newsroom sharing articles from other sources and talking about the competition. Now we're just being more open about it. Now we're just sharing the links.
This is David. I mean, all I was going to say is that scoops now have the half-life of a link. Right, it's that quick.
So true.
And you know, if you're a great linker, that is actually an editorial service. You know, if all Drudge Report really is, if you think about it, he's just a fantastic linker. And there's a lot of people who are just there's two types of bloggers: thinkers and linkers. And if you're a great linker, then you know you can own that space.
Define a great linker. What makes someone a great linker?
I guess, you know, keeps you coming back for more.
Well, I mean, yeah. It
but what do you issue, link to? What would you link to?
Well, the issue is, I mean, the Pixel Core internally, we have within our internal website, there's a kind of industry news, and it's a feed that's constantly going on, and that's generated primarily by me. And what happens is I have 30 RSS feeds that all get stacked, you know, and I just scroll through all the stories, and I click on ones that I think are interesting, and if they really are interesting, I link them to a delicious feed, you know, and that feed is what generates the feed that they see on the website, and that's just a service for our members of this is what I'm looking at. I mean, as the founder of the group,
right.
these are the things that I'm paying attention to. So it
that's
might be
Papa Bear.
Papa Bear, yeah, exactly. So I mean, that's
well,
a very
talking about what.
But it's
sorry,
useful.
Talking about what, yeah.
It gives them an indirect view of the direction we're going because that's what we're paying attention to or what we think is important. But then there's another list that someone else in the company generates for them. And then you have what we're going towards is being able to get to a point where it's almost like an internal dig where, you know, dig is very useful because you have a bunch of people that are theoretically like-minded that are voting it up and down. Now, it can be a little bit of a run by the, you know, mob rule.
Dig's kind of a popularity contest, isn't it?
It is to some degree, but you know, what I notice is that you know, it's one of the feeds. It's one of the many feeds that I have. You know, alongside Ars Technica and New York Times and The Economist and all kinds of other things that I'm looking at all the time. And you know, a third of the time I'm linking to something that I found in Dig. There is an enormous signal-to-noise ratio is not good
right.
in Dig, but there's still stories that you know you see from all over the world. And how I built the RSS feed was I actually started with Dig, and when I went to a site that I liked, I would then, a site that, oh, this whole site looks interesting, then why I'd add that RSS feed to my feed, you know? And so, I mean, I started with a handful. It wasn't just Dig. It was Dig and New York Times and a couple other ones. But But the point was is that as I saw these other ones, and Dig kind of gave me that open, and this is exactly what you're talking about, the relinking. Dig gave me this open, I got to see the world, you know, of all these different newspapers all over the world or all these different information sites, that if I just stayed within the sites that I had that weren't linking to anybody else, I would never see.
What about citizen journalism? I mean, as we talk about the type of things that David is working on, and Alex, I know you and I have had a lot of conversations about citizen journalism, and some of which, you know, there was a, when Dr. Kiki was on a few weeks ago, we talked about a CNN report that it was about Steve Jobs having health problems, and it turned out he wasn't, actually.
I think vetting is a real challenge.
So how does that, what needs to happen? I mean, do people have to become smarter and be able to sift through that? Or is there going to be better vetting done by the sites that employ citizen journalists? What do you think, David?
You just got to sort of the fundamental question. And I am a big supporter of citizen journalism. In fact, I've worked in it for a long time before Spot Us. And I think it's a positive development for journalism. But then you point to that Steve Jobs thing. It was on CNN's iReport. And that was a big sort of foul up for citizen journalism, you know, big quote unquote citizen journalism, because it had CNN's branding on it.
Right.
I think a lot of it does come down to media literacy, which is what you just pointed to, which is the same thing that we tell, you know, students when they look at something on Wikipedia, right? You got to go to the original source. You can't just use Wikipedia.
You mean Wikipedia isn't accurate?
Well, exactly, right?
I mean, love Wikipedia. It's well, so easy.
I love Wikipedia too, right? But if you're going to try and do, you wouldn't take it, you know, you wouldn't bet your life on it, right? You'd go
no,
try and find the original source.
It just feels so accurate. It feels like it's the... Sorry.
And I think what it comes down to with citizen journalism is it comes down to the individuals, because journalism will survive the death of its institutions. That's a quote from a woman named Lisa Williams. Without the institutions there that sort of act as the, oh, you can trust this, it's from this institution, you can trust this, it's in San Francisco Chronicle, you can trust this, it's in the LA Times, it comes down to, you can trust this, it's from David Cohn, or you can trust this, and it comes down to the individuals, and you're going to learn who you do and don't trust.
Well, and I think that it's important, and we've talked about this on the show before, but I do think it's important for us to also have a very tempered level of trust for everything that goes by. You know, right. we've talked about this before, that, you know, anytime someone writes about any subject that you know a lot about, you read that article and you go, this guy has no idea what he's talking
about. Yeah, like when I read Brian's stories, I'm like, what the heck
is
that?
But I look at people. I live
in fear of that.
You know, I grew
exactly.
up on a, I remember, because I was in politics, you know, I mean, not, I wasn't in politics, my parents were in politics. And so I knew the ins and outs of whatever was going on. And then I'd see a reporter reporting about it, and I was like, he obviously has no idea what's going on, you know, because that's not at all. I mean, I'm in there for the conversations. I mean, I know exactly what's going on, and he's telling people like he knows, and there's not, and then it'll be something else, and then it'll be something else. And you kept on anything I knew about, but anything that was reported on that I didn't know anything about, I go, oh, well, that must be, I suddenly realized that I was just assuming that was the truth because I didn't have any reference. And so and it's not anybody's fault. It's just that journalists are journalists. They're not scientists or politicians or whatever. And so they're trying to grab that information, and some are really good at it and some aren't, you know, and the thing is, what I think is interesting about citizen journalism is the opportunity for people who are experts, and they may be experts in their own field, or they may be experts in their own locality. You know, they really know Freeport, Pennsylvania, or they really know whatever, telling you about what's going on there. And I think that for me, I always think of Zimbabwe when I'm there, that at some point in time, you know, we're going to have, there's going to be another election that might actually mean something down there. And, and CNN's going to send two guys from Atlanta, and they're going to ask the taxi driver what's going on down there. And, you know, but eventually there's going to be Shona and Indabili and, you know, ZANU-PF and MDC, and all these guys are going to be shooting video and putting up on the web. None of it's true. But neither is CNN.
CNN needs to hire you as a consultant when it covers Zimbabwe so they can get accurate
reporting. I think that the opportunity, though, is to figure out a way to start sorting through it. The idea is that you can, by seeing lots of samples, you can start to see that the truth is somewhere in the middle. It's not either one or the other.
I was going to say, I mean, and there's a site called Global Voices, actually, which does just that. They have people in different countries, and they're not, you know, quote unquote journalists, but they live and breathe in that country, and they'll blog and tell you. And you got exactly to the heart of what's really powerful about citizen journalism, which is that, you know, your readers know more than you do, right? And I'm sure Brian would agree to this. There's always an expert in something that is much smarter than you about that topic. And, you know, using blogs or simple tools, they can now express that. I used to be a science and tech reporter, and I think it would be much harder to be a science reporter because there are a lot of scientists who just blog, and I would much, you know, I would recommend their blogs over what I was writing
today
because I wasn't the scientist.
But at the same time, sometimes you need someone who's really good at distilling that information, because the scientists will give you an enormous amount of information, and it'll go right over most people's heads, and so you have to have someone who can go, okay, well, we're gonna.
And here's where, and I'll give the sort of case for professional journalism, because again, I've worked in citizen journalism. It does have its limits. One of them is that, you know, journalism is a craft, and if you do it every day, you get better at it, right? Citizen journalists don't do it every day. They do have a 9-to-5 job. And the second thing is, and this comes, again, back to my direct experience with citizen journalism, it's hard work, and sometimes the citizens don't want to always do it all. If you ask a citizen to do a long, in-depth investigation, they'll be like, man, this is like redoing my college midterm paper. This is really hard. I don't want to do this. I have a 9-to-5 job. I have 2 kids. I just want to relax and have fun. And I don't blame them. They have every right to, you know, they work their job. They have every right to relax. So you do need someone who is able to make a living sticking to the story for a long period of time, because that's how you get in-depth, long-form pieces. And we do need those.
It's a good point that you make about distilling information. Now, when I moderate a lot of panels at trade shows, and when I do my prep calls, I always say to the people, what would you like me to ask you? Or if you were in the audience, what would you ask yourselves? Because I'm not going to pretend to be a subject matter expert. I mean, I know enough about new media to be dangerous. You know, I know enough about it for, you know, to be fortunate enough that Alex allows me to host a show. And for that I'm grateful. But I think that, and what I say to people when I do the panels is, what I'm good at is asking questions and thinking on my feet. And I hope also being able to distill information, because that's what you really do need to do as a journalist. I mean, I think, you know, think about all the times that we're on the phone having a half hour conversation. At the end of the day, you got to come up with, okay, so basically what you're saying, Bob, is your business turns widgets into watermelons, right? And he's like, yes, exactly. You got it. Perfect. Okay, fine. That's what I write. And that is an important skill. And yes, sometimes when you do read a blog or something else, you have to sift through a lot of information to learn about the widget watermelon technology that is out there and very important. But now, this brings up a really good point about where we'll be getting our news from, and Alex, is it accurate, and all of that. And I wonder how much we actually want unbiased news anymore. I mean, there have, especially when it comes to politics, and look, I know the listeners don't want to have another political conversation, and I respect that and understand that. But I wonder if we really want unbiased news sources. There was an article, I don't think it was by Brian, but it was in the New York Times right before the election, about the popularity of course, Fox News has been popular for a very long time, and MSNBC started rising in popularity when it decided to become a left-leaning network. And when you think back to the early days of journalism, of print journalism, you know, in the 20s and the 30s, most of the newspapers had political bents. I mean, we know what a lot of them are today, but for many others, they really try to be straight down the middle. But I wonder if that is what people even want anymore, if we want not just distillation, but also a point of view.
Well, it's Brian again. I think we want both. You know, I think there are times where we're going to want someone who will tell us which of all the citizen journalist reports are the correct one. You know, for example, last week, a lot of people on Twitter thought that Michael Mukasey, the attorney general, had died when he collapsed while speaking. It turned out there was a person in the room who was tweeting, who was saying Mukasey's alive, the EMTs are coming in now. She was the voice of reason that night. But most people didn't find her tweet. So we need people who are going to find that information and distill it for us. But the vast majority of the time, I think that people also want the Keith Olbermans and the Bill O'Reillys. And an interesting point is, you know, come up with Alan Colmes leaving Hannity and Colmes, the liberal half of Hannity and Colmes on the Fox News Channel, leaving the program. Well, there's a possibility now that Sean Hannity, the conservative, will be the only host of the show. Another indication, I think, that people want that kind of news that comes with opinion.
Yeah, maybe people who watch Fox News don't need to know what...
Well,
so the other side thinks, and that's okay.
Here's what I would say. I think Brian has a point in that. Well, I'll back up and actually quote Brian. If the news is important, it will find me. I think that's how the quote goes, right, Brian?
Yeah, but I think it was like a 15-year-old at some panel that said that.
I thought that was a brilliant observation, in that there will always be, you know, sort of news with an angle. But if it's a really hard hitting piece of news that the other sort of side needs to, you know, I'm the San Francisco liberal here, right? If Bill O'Reilly does have something, you know, absolutely amazing, fantastic to say, it'll find me. I honestly believe that. And I also think that there is this notion of objectivity in sort of old school, you know, newspaper type reporting, which it's really a myth. I think that good reporting needs to be accurate, and it needs to be thorough, and it needs to be fair. But this idea of like objectivity, I think, is something that we sort of place on top of it and say, oh, well, this is objective. So, but there's no such thing, really.
Now, Patrick, I'd love to hear from you on this. What's your take on objectivity, and do we actually want that?
Well, I'm personally not a big fan of this ideal of objectivity. If you look at like the UK press, they don't practice it. They practice what we in America would call advocacy journalism, which isn't quite like MSNBC or Fox News, which are kind of more along the lines of partisan. But you read The Economist, you know that coming into The Economist, they support free markets, they support globalization, they kind of have a libertarian bent to them. And you know that ahead of time. All their publications kind of have this. It's not saying that they're going to be cheerleaders, but you know what their journalists are practicing when you go in there ahead of time. And the major U.S. papers, I mean, they must think I'm stupid to really think that the New York Times, Washington Post really is right down the middle. I live in D.C. I'm friends with a lot of the elite journalists, and I know their political views. And the idea that people could sort of just completely throw those out the window and then do objective reporting, I think, is a fallacy. And I think people appreciate it when you're honest with them. So I don't know if that is directly going to lead us down the path of more Fox Newses or more MSNBCs. It may lead us down the path towards having some economist-like papers pop up. The Guardian, and nobody really thinks of The Guardian or The Economist in the same waters as Fox News or MSNBC. They're much more esteemed publications, but they both are, neither one is what we would consider objective. And I would say that both of them are superior to any of the American newspaper institutions. So I do see us going down that path, because it's harder and harder to maintain this facade of objectivity, and especially on the web. And I hear from a lot of reporters who go on Twitter and go on social networks that they just feel like they're waiting for somebody to catch them with one of their tweets or one of their blog posts and say, aha, I finally figured out what your slant is.
Oh, that you're really biased.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, well, if you just admit ahead of time, you know, it doesn't mean you're a Democrat or Republican. And I, you know, I'm an independent, but that doesn't mean I don't have views. If I can go out and just tell people ahead of time, this is who I am, this is what I do, then people aren't going to spend their time doing that. And I think it, in the end, would make journalism better.
That's an interesting point. Now, I think this is obviously not as important as politics and the world around us. But in my particular world in TV, one of the things that we're supposed to do at Television Week in our stories is not to reflect our own tastes for different TV shows in our stories. Okay, and there are our stories, but most of us now, most reporters who write stories also have columns and also write blogs. And I've just tried to be, as soon as I had a blog and then when I had a column, you have to be very upfront, and I'm not going to say the GA TV show, but everybody who knows me knows what I like to watch, and I admit it. And
Grey's Anatomy.
In that sense, you get your biases out from the get-go. People know what I like to watch. I mean, you read my column, you read my blog, you know that on the web, you know I'm a huge fan of Martin Sargent. You know that. That's not a secret. You know that I watch The Office. You know I like The Daily Show. I mean, those things, and I think that's a good point, Patrick. You just kind of get it out there so people know what they're dealing with when they read your stuff from the get-go. And you can't like everything and you can't watch everything, but when I have to write a story that involves being objective, I mean, I really thought about this when Revision 3 had its layoffs. You know, and I had to say, as much as I liked watching Internet Superstar, I had to say the show didn't find an audience, or the show wasn't popular enough, or whatever it was. I don't remember exactly how I phrased it, but there was sort of this moment of reflection of, this is a show that I liked. I'm bummed that it's no longer on the air, but I still have to say something about it that reflects that it wasn't a strong enough performer in Revision 3's eyes to continue on its lineup. And that's what you have to do. You put your biases out there, as you say, but then when you're doing the reporting, you keep reporting.
I think, you know, another way to phrase this is that, you know, there's this principle in new media that you're allowed to be human. And that was something that, you know, reporters 30, 40 years ago, they almost weren't allowed to be real people. They, you know, they had this professional life. They couldn't even talk about how they voted, right? There are people who got fired because, you know, they said, I voted this way. And it's this idea that, you know, we talk about citizen journalists, and yet journalists aren't allowed to be citizens too. But in new media, you know, that divide sort of disappears. You're allowed to just be a person. I even try and put jokes on my blog occasionally, right? That's
journalists
okay.
Can make jokes.
Yeah, I know. We have sense of we have a sense of humor too. But you know, going back to sort of not to try and steer away from where this is going, but the real problem though is how do you continue to make a living being a person and also going back to, you know, doing the reporting that you need to do, as you said. I mean,
how do you do that?
Well, here's a question for you guys. You guys are through sponsorship, right? You have advertisers and you're able to sort of pay for the show that way, right?
I take bribes mostly. That's how I like to fund.
You do have a sponsor.
Yes. Let's do our sponsor at 50 minutes.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I was so into the show. So our sponsor actually for this show is Object Matrix. Now, Object Matrix is what these guys do is put together very, very high performance RAID systems. So essentially, I mean, this is like bank level. So if people really need to make sure that your data stays where it's supposed to, you know, you can use an Object Matrix system. Now, the important thing is that a lot of people think of it as really expensive. It's, you know, they think of it as, this is the kind of enterprise level software that you would expect. The first 15 terabytes is free. It's just the software. I mean, you need to buy the hardware for it, but it manages the software from there. So if you've got a couple Mac Minis, if you've got some Drobos or some other little drives, you can set up your own basic Object Matrix. And what it does is it makes sure that there's always two copies, always. Two copies somewhere. And so it will, if one drive goes down, it slowly moves everything over to make sure that there's two copies there. So it's a very, it's a low cost, very secure disk based archive system designed primarily for video and film production, although companies like banks use it. It's also set up with an ideal solution for Final Cut Pro Studio and Final Cut Server workflows. They really built it around the Final Cut server. So you can really set that up very, very easily. And so definitely check it out. You can find more information at finalcutstorage.com.
So there you go.
You're
there you go.
You're
thank you very much.
Yes. So to go back to the
otherwise, I would have been somewhere in the afterwards. I would have been like, okay, where are we going to cut that in?
Exactly. Put the ad in. Ads are very important. We like our advertisers because they let us do what we love. And yes, we're ad-supported TV Week. Obviously, the New York Times is.
Well, not to say that there's an answer to this question, but what I was going to try and go towards is, I think actually tech reporting and sort of tech media is actually doing all right. I mean, you look at some of the most popular blogs on the web, and you got things like TechCrunch and ReadWrite Web. I think they're doing all right. But the question is will you be able to support sort of civic journalism or, you know, eat your vegetables journalism with advertising? And to be honest with you, I'm not sure.
That's going to be the tough one. You're right. That's the tough one, because I think what we're finding and what we talk about a lot, this goes back to the content that you produce, Alex, for your clients, is the niche stuff. I really do think it will have a home because people want that, because you don't necessarily... I mean, yes, I endeavor to break stories on a daily basis, but more importantly, I hope to be able to give to find the enterprise stories on my beat and offer that up. But it is the Christian Science Monitors of the world that are trying to do the general journalism. I think they're going to have somewhat of a tougher time. It's the regional newspapers. And again, I think Patrick said this, or you said this as well, David, but you look at the papers that have very strong brands, a Wall Street Journal, a New York Times, a Washington Post. I mean, those have incredibly strong brands, and people will turn to those for that broader picture news. I think people will turn to the Ars Technica, I hope, to TV Week, to Brian's reports in the New York Times. But beyond that, you're right. I don't know. I don't know what happens to the local water main type of stories. Well,
you know, I don't want to get too theoretical, but isn't part of the problem of journalism as we know it right now the fact that it happens every day and it's a series of these single articles that come out one after the other after the other? I think one of the directions we have to think about moving in is an idea of a living article. I don't really know what to call it, but we're doing some experiments here, and I hope other papers are doing other experiments with the idea that the news does not happen at noon and get written about at midnight in the paper. It continues to happen. It keeps flowing. And so stories like that, perhaps, are the kinds of stories that you write an article, you update it online a couple of days later, you keep revising it, more of a Wikipedia model for journalism. And I think we have to do more experiments like that. We can't think of news as just one article like this anymore.
You're right. That's a good point.
Is that too theoretical? Is that too in the cloud?
I think that's great. In fact, the tagline for my blog for a long time has always been journalism is a process, not a product. And I think too often we think of it as this sort of finished product that gets slapped down on in a newspaper in front of your doorstep and it's finished. And that's not the case. Journalism is a living, breathing process. And the problem, though, and I'm glad that the New York Times and others are experimenting in this, is that we need to figure out how to keep that process and sort of update it, because it's still using the institutional structure from the last century. So what we need right now is as much experimentation as possible.
It's a good point. I'm working on a story for the December 1st issue of Television Week on venture funding, and we had done a prior story on the topic about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and during our editorial calls today, my editor said, we need to make sure that whatever changes you're documenting in that 5 week period since the last article on this particular topic are recorded in the new story. So it's not just a one-off, so that we're acknowledging, hey, we wrote about this topic 5 weeks ago. And to be transparent about it and to say, here's what we found 5 weeks ago, here's what's different now, here's what's different in our reporting, here's what's different in what people are telling us. So in that sense, I hope that it can feel like more of that living article concept, well, rather than just one-off where we forget, where we have blinders on, that not so much that it was a mistake, but that points of views have changed since then.
Well, I think a good example of that actually is Wikipedia. Wikipedia is a subject that keeps on changing. Wikipedia sometimes will react almost as fast as a newspaper.
It's so fast.
I mean, things are just up there immediately. And they're constantly changing. It's constantly being revised, and there's a history of that revision. That's built into the system, and people are constantly checking it back and forth. It doesn't mean that it's always accurate, but nothing is. And so the thing is that it's, I think that gets to that idea of this. And I don't think Wikipedia is the answer, but I think that there's an interesting example there of a living document that is much more current. And the reason that I find myself going to Wikipedia at least to start a lot of research. It's not where I end, but because it's much more current oftentimes than anything I'm going to find in Encyclopedia Britannica or some kind of regular reference, because that's going to be updated every certain number of months or years or whatever. And Wikipedia, I know that if it's a relatively important subject, it'll be updated, within the day, or a week.
Now, Patrick, I want to move back to a topic we've touched on a little bit. I'm really fascinated by the idea of how journalists use social media. I know that I've done this myself, but what are you finding are some of the most innovative ways and useful for readers ways that journalists are incorporating social media into their news gathering?
I think it depends on the beat and then the social media. Different beats work a lot better with different media types. For instance, Facebook, for most journalists, I don't think really is going to do you a lot of good. But if you cover education, and specifically part of your job is to talk to students, being on Facebook can be a godsend, especially if there's one beat blogger I follow, and he covers University of Nebraska. So he got Nebraska to give him a nebraska.edu email account. So he got on that network. So every time he needs to look for, he's doing a story maybe, and he's defined like an accounting major, for instance, as a sophomore, he can go on there, he can parse that information, he can look through different people, and he uses it to be able to contact different people. Other people, use their networks to help give them information, help give them tips. One of the people I follow is Kent Fisher. He does not really use like Twitter or Facebook or the social media sites, but rather he's made his blog into kind of a community. He's cultivated this community. And so what has happened is now that people that that would have never been sources before are now sending him information. He covers the Dallas School District, K-12, and a lot of his readers actually work for the district, and so they'll send him documents. And the school district often will stonewall him and obviously doesn't want him to know about everything that's going on. There was actually just recently a big scandal where there was a gigantic, unexpected, somewhere in the neighborhood about $80 million budget shortfall. And without his blog, without his social network, a lot of those stories wouldn't have been reported. But instead, they helped him break the story, and they also continuously send him internal documents that he would normally not be able to get a hold of. So the biggest thing is no matter what the network really is, when you build that community, you're going to start getting people who would have never been your sources before. We kind of call it Rolodex 2.0, where if you're a traditional newspaper or broadcast reporter, you've got your narrow focus of sources, but they're typically only a handful of people, insiders, and you go back to them time and time again. Where now he's got this gigantic network, or really probably thousands of people that are willing to give him information, and there's a lot of especially teachers and administrators who are now willing to tip him off to things going on. He's able to cover his beat a lot better and probably a lot more efficiently now that he's getting so much help from all these people.
Now, I have to say that's where I enjoy Twitter just as a place to kind of have fun and, you know, post silly things at times, you know, what's your favorite movie line ever, or what's your most played song on your iPod, just because I think those are fun conversations to have. And I like getting to know the listeners from the show or people that follow me on Twitter and I follow back and whatnot. So I think those are fun just for the social conversation. But where I found it particularly useful is there's a service called ProfNet, which I used to use. I used it when I did a little bit more broad-based consumer stuff. So I don't need it as much anymore. But it's a service where you're looking for a source or experts in a particular area, and it gets blasted out. Your request gets blasted out to, you know, PR agencies, government agencies, and whatnot. And I found that, you know, sort of the Twitter, Facebook link, where, you know, I'm able to reach about 3,000 people together collectively, replicates that in my beat. You know, I was looking for interactive marketing experts, and I posted it on Friday, and I got all the people I needed. I've got interviews lined up for stories. And what's really exciting is I get in touch with sources that I don't normally have. You know, usually when I'm working on an advertising-related story, I'm calling the media buyers, and I love them, and they're wonderful. But I'm calling folks at MediaVest, at Starcom, at Initiative, and I have good relationships with those agencies and hope to continue to. But you want to broaden it out. You want to keep it fresh. So when I posted that, I was able to connect with folks that I didn't know, folks at sort of interesting, either nichier agencies or more branding type of agencies that are actually probably going to be more applicable for stories. And another way that I like to use it is almost kind of combining, sort of making a little bit citizen journalism. Like I'll ask a certain question. Over the weekend, my question was, you know, what sports do you watch online and how? And I took some of the responses and just put them as quotes within the story that's going to run next week. So you're starting with, you know, the reporting that I do as a journalist, but then I'm ending it with, but don't just take it from me. Here is what other people are doing. Here are four or five quotes from, you know, from what people all around the country or all around the world are doing. So you get that kind of reflection. Now, Brian, do you, I know you're very active on that. To what degree are you able to incorporate, you know, responses from, you know, from friends and followers into your stories?
Very rarely do I directly take something I, you know, receive on Twitter and put it either into print or on the web. Obviously, the space on the web is larger, so I have more of a tendency to use some of the Twitter comments on my blog. What I use it for is a much more of an indirect sort of you know, improvements to my story, suggestions that come from readers, story ideas that come from readers, points about a subject that I haven't thought about that come from readers. You know, it's a subtle sort of improvement. But it is an improvement. You know, it makes the readers feel more connected, and obviously it helps my reporting. So I think a lot of it is subtle but valuable. And it also, you know, I think it's broadly becoming more and more important for reporters to know how to navigate social media. You know, it's not just Twitter and Facebook and MySpace. Over the weekend, I was reporting about the 19-year-old who killed himself while online and in a chat room and on message boards, and being able to surf around that forum on bodybuilding.com Google.com, being able to navigate it and find my way around it and find the users on it, you know, really helped the story in a way that I think that the reporters, you know, have to become more able to do that, I think, more broadly. Because so many more stories play out online now, you know, that kind of social knowledge becomes more and more important.
Brian, where can people find you online?
BrianStelter.com, I suppose.
All right.
You know, I always tell people to Google me, and you know, the second result is my email and phone number. So
easy
I
enough.
Try to be as reachable as possible.
And on the Twitter, you're Brian Stelter. You use
Brian
your name.
Stelter.
All right. Very
one
good.
One stop.
Patrick, where can people find you online?
People can find me at beatblogging.org. You can also find me on my personal site, which is patthortonfiles.com. If you either Google Patrick or Pat Thornton, I'm the number one result for both of them. And on Twitter, Twitter and a lot of different networks, you can find me at jiconoclast.
And I will, I'll link these all. I'll do show notes or something. So don't worry, we'll get this info to you. David, where can people find you?
Most places you can find me, I'm under DigiDave, DigiDave. That's my personal blog and Twitter and all that other stuff. And then, of course, I have my new nonprofit startup, Spot Us, at the URL spot.us, where people can give $5 to help support independent journalists.
Fabulous. And Alex?
I'm on the Twitters.
Alex Lindsay. I always have to give your name. Hello. It's Alex Lindsay on the Twitters. And
Where can people find you?
Yeah, you know what? I just want people to find me on Twitter because I need to get more followers than Brian this week.
Not that you're competitive or
proof
anything.
Proof that journalism, competition in journalism is alive and well. No, Brian, I expect you to always stay ahead of me until I finally get a job at the New York Times. And then I'll really...
You're not very far behind. You're a day behind.
Oh, you're too kind.
What's your Twitter? I'll help you right now.
There you go. Got some Twitter love. All right, I'll give that to you after the show. We are over and out.